New World Witchery is a Patreon-supported podcast. This episode is supported by listener Meg. Thank you, Meg, for all your support. And we are sending you on an all-expenses-paid astral trip to Tuscany for your efforts. Just close your eyes and imagine those waving fields of sunflowers. If you'd like to become a patron and help support the show while also getting some great perks, please visit www.patreon.com/newworldwitchery where you can pledge $1 a month or whatever you can to help us get Meg back. Turns out the astral ticket was a one-way and now she's stuck in the Akashic Airport in Milan. Thanks to all of our listeners.
Are you looking for magic? Maybe magic that lives right where you do?
If so, join us aboard our broomsticks and ride with us from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Yukon to the Yucatan, and find magic that's right outside your front door or just off of Route 66.
Whether you're in the Windy City or the Crescent City, the city that never sleeps, or the city of brotherly love, we've got enchantment for you.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane, and this is New World Witchery.
This time we're pouring out the olive oil and hanging up the garlic braids as we discuss Italian-American folk magic with Dee Norman. Confession time. Mostly, I don't listen to a lot of witchy podcasts. Don't get me wrong, I do have my favorites, and my ears get plenty of time learning about magic from a variety of perspectives. But when it comes to my podcast choices, I vary pretty widely. Food, horror movies, science, and history. I do love a good history show. Whether that's the thoughtful audio essays of Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History, or the more chat-based format of What You Missed in History Class. But one of my favorites? Mike Duncan's The History of Rome podcast. In it, historian-storyteller Duncan covers the nearly thousand-year history of what we think of as ancient Rome in several hundred episodes, mostly focusing on battles, emperors, intrigues, and shifting political boundaries that made the empire so successful and ultimately may have led to its downfall. But among all those episodes, he occasionally has some of what we might call micro-histories that talk about what everyday people did. How breakfast for a typical Roman citizen was a handful of nuts and dried fruit that they ate on their way out the door to go and do a tour of all their patrons. Why walking through the darkened streets of the city at night was a highly dangerous affair. And how visiting the baths was about hygiene, but also about social structures and building communities. It's the world of the Roman folk as much as anything. In those folksier moments, though, Duncan sometimes misses out on the spiritual life of the Romans, how they might have interacted with the Lares in their home, or what superstitions might have guided their everyday activities. But over time, those beliefs and actions have permeated not just ancient Roman, but much later Italian cultural traditions. Beliefs in the evil eye and how to break it. Beliefs in what sorts of luck a person could expect or what signs might be trying to tell you on any given day when you step outside your door. Over time, many of these beliefs also melded with the booming Catholic Church's traditions, so honoring Lares became venerating saints. But still, the magic remained underneath it all. And that magic has come down to us today. That's why my guest this evening will be Dee Norman, who will be talking about how those traditions of Italian folk belief and magic have grown and changed over time, and what they look like today. Not just for those in Italy, but crucially, for those in the Italian diaspora, especially Italian Americans. She shares her own family history and stories, as well as some of the key points from her recent book, Burn a Black Candle, an Italian-American Grimoire. We're delighted to have her with us, and we hope you will be too. Our guest this time around is Dee Norman, the author of Burn a Black Candle, an Italian-American Grimoire. Dee grew up in her family's Italian-American magical tradition and has been a student of cartomancy since the mid-1980s. Over the past 20 years, she's been creating and presenting workshops on tarot, Lenormand, and a variety of practical magical topics. She's been a professional card reader since the late 1990s. She's got clients around the globe. She's hunted ghosts in Australia and the United States, has been a high priestess for 3 teaching covens, and is the creator of the Occult Observatory, the largest active club of its kind on Clubhouse. Dee, you stay very busy, so thank you so much for making time for us and chatting with us here on New World Witchery.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Delighted to have you. I mean, just reading that list, I was already like, whew, I need a nap. So you stay very busy. But let's go all the way back here. You've obviously been doing magic for a very long time, working within magical traditions. I want to kind of start with the magic that shaped you from an early age, because you grew up in an Italian-American family. So I'm curious, what were some of the ways that you saw magic around you in those early years?
Well, it was very, very subtle. And I like talking to people about that a lot, because I think sometimes when we grow, we're fish, we swim in an ocean, we don't see the water we swim in sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, growing up, it was little hints of things here and there when I was young, because it was considered, you know, adult topic of conversation or adult activities. And so I wasn't allowed a full view of what was going on. But there was very much burning of black candles, because they were considered both a preventative for the evil eye and a cure for the evil eye. There was, of course, the traditional evil eye oil and water cure. And then there were other practices done to ensure prosperity for the household and protection for the household. And then as I got older, I got to witness some other very interesting practices that maybe weren't as positive. Mm-hmm. And some work with the saints. And so, you know, as I was as I got older and got more and more interested in magic in general and folk magic, I started asking more pointed questions. But it took a lot of questioning and a lot of insistence, even with my own mother and grandmother, to get them to open up and talk about some of the things that they did.
Mm. And so do they still kind of view this as a sort of taboo topic? Are they more open about talking about it now? I mean, now that you're kind of published and writing about this, is this something that they know about and share more with you?
Yeah, it is something that they know about. My grandmother unfortunately passed a few years ago. And so she passed before I started writing the book. My mother, however, is still happily with us. And, you know, I remember her getting a hold of my copy of the book that I gave her and looking at it and going, wow, you certainly got a lot in here. And I kind of cringed and went, well, what do you think? And she said, no, I think this is wonderful. And she was excited to see it all in print. I think as a because she realized the perspective that I was coming from, that A, it was honoring all these things that I loved and experienced growing up. Mm-hmm. And B, I really wanted something for my daughter to pass on, because my daughter wouldn't know my grandmother, wouldn't know my great aunts, wouldn't know the other older people in the family who had already passed before she got to an age where she might be interested in some of these things. So it was definitely an effort to strengthen that chain from past to future. And so Mom and Grandma were, as once they realized that I pretty much considered both folk magic and like ceremonial magic my calling in life and something that I was going to be involved with, and it wasn't just some childhood phase, they really opened up and also were very curious about the other quote real magic that I did that wasn't our family magic, because they never considered what they did magic. They're like, oh, we don't do real magic like your crazy LBRP stuff, you know, we're not doing real magic like you. So, but they were open to talk, even to my friends who were also magical practitioners later on in life, and were willing to share techniques and insights with them too. So they did come around, but it took some long-term interest on my part and some convincing that I really did care about what they were doing.
I think that's really wonderful. I like the point that you make about this being a a sort of a thread that's being woven between multiple generations, kind of a chain stitch that's going on from grandmother to mother to you to your daughter, and carrying not just the magic itself, which is very important, but also this sort of family bond, this family connection forward. I think that's really beautiful. And so one thing I wanted to ask you about, there's a scholar named Robert Orsi who wrote a book called Madonna of 115th Street, where he talks about some of the first kind of Italian-American immigrants who sort of took up residence in Harlem. And one of the points that he makes is that when you talk to people who live in Italy, people who are Italians living in Italy, they're often very, very fiercely defensive of the fact that they are, you know, Tuscan or Calabrian or Sicilian, right? But once you get into the diaspora and sort of the United States, that sort of Italian-American umbrella becomes much more enfolding and encompassing. And I'm curious, is that something you feel is true for you and for the magic that you see here in that community?
Very much so. You know, I know that I think for some other families, their specific origin in Italy, their region that they come from is very significant. And the regions are very, very diverse and have a great difference in practices in the Italian peninsula itself. But when by the time it got down to my generation, we were just Italian American. We were very, very proud of the fact that we were Italian American, but there wasn't a great amount of attention paid to, you know, Naples, Benevento, Calabria, which are all places that my family came from, that I have found out later through genealogical research and from talking to people in my family. But it was never, those places were never presented as more significant to me as just the general Italian peninsula itself. And I think that part of that reason is that in the very act of leaving Italy and coming to the United States, many, many things were lost. Many, many regional differences were blended together to create a third new wonderful thing in Italian-American practices. And so my family didn't really differentiate or specify the different regions that we came from until I started asking questions.
Mm. And so those questions, I think, they sort of led you to uncover some of these pieces of, you know, lore, information, history as well. I'm curious, did it change the way that you worked with the traditions and rituals, the holidays that you celebrate by sort of encountering these new differentiations, or does it still kind of fall under a more sort of general Italian-American umbrella?
I'm fascinated by all, I mean, when you really, really think of it, each family, each Italian-American family has their own thread of practices, if they do practice folk magic, that has come down through the generations, and it has been affected by all the different experiences of all of those family members being concentrated and coming down to the next generation and the next generation. So if you look at it that way, every single Italian-American family has their own specific tradition that has been developed and shaped over time by the family's experiences. I am fascinated in the variations that I find in the United States and just North America in general about how other families' practices differ and match up to my family's practices. And of course, I'm fascinated by some of the information that I find out about the practices that go on in Italy, while still remaining aware of the fact that those practices, though they're the generators of, or the origins of what my family does, it went through a lot of leaps and changes and mixtures with other practices before it came down to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples of like a particular, you know, charm or practice or ritual or you know, even a recipe, right, for food that might be associated with a holiday or something like that, that you can point to as like, oh, here's how my family does it versus here's how maybe somebody else's family did it?
Well, I can definitely say that there are wide and varied differences in the oil and water cure for the Imbiancai, for example. That's the first thing that springs to mind, because it is so varied and there's so many different techniques and so many different ways to interpret the results and so many different prayers. And each family has their own specific prayers that are used in order to diagnose and cure the evil eye. But I can also point to things like, so when I would speak to my grandmother in particular, she did not draw any lines between what I would call a magical practice or a healing practice or, you know, a household maintenance practice. That she kind of lumped all of those things together because she didn't specifically consider what she was doing magic. And so one of the things that she would tell me about was a cold remedy that her father taught her, and it incorporated, it was a poultice that was placed on the chest, of course, fairly typical cold remedy. But she started listing to me the ingredients, and I started getting very excited about this because I'm like, wow, I'm going to actually capture this entire thing. And then she hesitated and faltered and went, and then there's this plant. And I said, okay, what plant? And she said, I don't know what plant because my father could never find it in the United States. And I said, well, what was it called? And she said, I don't know. He just described it to me like, you know, his mother described it to him like, hey, go out and pick this plant because we need to make this cure. So we have no name. We have, you know, this vague description of a plant that grew somewhere in Italy, in southern Italy, probably in the Naples region, but that's all we've got. And so I keep, you know, as I talk to people who have different familial practices or maybe who have closer ties to Italian practices in, you know, in southern Italy, I occasionally say, hey, have you ever heard of a cold cure that, you know, helps with congestion and that might involve a particular kind of plant? I haven't found anything yet, but I hope springs eternal that one day someone somewhere will be aware of a similar recipe and I might get some closure on what that plant was.
Oh, who knows? Maybe somebody listening to this will be like, oh, I think I know what it is. Maybe they'll send it in. It's funny how often that happens when people hear, you know, things like this. They'll hear little bits of lore that they're like, wait, that reminds me of, and then they'll send something in. And it's always delightful to learn that way. So I'm curious. So you had these things that you grew up with, but you also obviously were growing up in sort of a neighborhood or a community where there were other Italian-American folks, Italian-American families. Were there any like specific charms that you can remember that you learned, not from your family, but from somebody else within the community that really stuck with you?
Well, here's the interesting thing for me. So the bulk of my Italian American family was in New Jersey. And before I was born, my mother's father was promoted to a job that took him to Louisville, Kentucky. So Louisville doesn't have no Italian Americans in it, but it doesn't have a huge Italian American population. And so all of my communal experience happened when we went, quote, back home, as my mother would call it, when we would pile into the car and we would go to New Jersey and we would visit with family. And the thing that I found, and this may be specific to my family, is that it did not take expressing knowledge or interest in kind of more esoteric or some of these magical techniques before you were instantly labeled as some kind of expert. And so I became the family go-to person very, very young, like in my 20s, of people coming and asking for card readings and other things like that, but was not often offered solutions by the wider family or recipes or techniques by the wider family, the wider community. I think because there was this idea that kind of I was under my mother and grandmother's tutelage and that they're going to give me the information that I need to have so that I can then serve the family almost, you know, and so I did not get as much of the instruction that I would have, I think, had I grown up in New Jersey, 24/7 there all the time, not just there on family vacations and for family special events and things like that. So we would sweep into New Jersey, we would visit with the family, there would be all this commotion, we'd have various experiences there, and then we would go back to Louisville and suddenly things would feel much more empty.
That's a really interesting description. That's sort of like the sort of crowded versus empty. I think that's a really fascinating thing to sort of put into perspective there. I'm curious, you know, did living in the South, you know, it has its own kind of series of magical traditions and its own sort of magical landscape. And not that New Jersey doesn't, New Jersey absolutely does. But I'm curious, like, did that landscape affect you at all?
Oh, I think it did 100%. I think partially because, you know, you're constantly comparing, at least I am, with my magical practice and the magical practice of those individuals around me, what they do, how they do it, how that compares to what I do. And even if it's something that I don't want to adopt, it always ends up informing what I do practice. But also, having grown up with any kind of magical tradition in my family opened doors for me to talk to other people with traditional folk practices, I think, that otherwise maybe those doors would not have been open. People would not have been as willing to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to be privy sometimes to some very interesting conversations on more Southern conjure, Southern folk magic, and some, you know, other family traditions that were remarkably similar in some cases to what I did, sometimes very different. But I don't think, without being able to start conversations sometimes with, well, my grandmother always did X, Y, Z, and kind of to nudge people along, you know, I don't know if I would have gotten as easy access to some of those conversations.
Mm. I'm glad that it worked in your favor on that one then, for sure. You mentioned, for example, saints earlier, and I mean, I think it's almost impossible to talk about, for example, Italian American folk magic. It's true for a lot of folk magic that makes its way into the United States, Irish American as well, and several others. But there's definitely this sort of Catholic inflection or Catholic influence, I think, on a lot of the folk magical practices. And I'm curious, you know, how has that sort of intersection shaped what you do, or how do you negotiate that sort of the sort of role of Catholicism within your practice?
It's very interesting to me. It didn't make as much of an impression growing up, but at one point my grandmother, I was concerned about something, and my grandmother actually told me that you only really need the Catholic Church three times in your life, born, when you're married, and when you die. She actually did say that to me. Uh-huh. And it, which I was like, wow. So there was this great love of the saints and Mary and sometimes Jesus. And we acknowledge God occasionally. Mm-hmm. And but also this kind of disdain, distrust of the church itself. Like, the buildings and accoutrements and rituals were all fantastic, but the doctrine weren't. Mom and grandma played fast and loose with the doctrine. Mm-hmm. Some of my favorite examples of this is my mother including a statue of Saint Francis in her nativity scene every year, because, and me, when I laughed at it, sure, getting very mad at me and her feelings hurt, and saying Saint Francis could be at the nativity if he wanted to be. I said, is he a time traveler? And she would just get so annoyed.
Like, all the animals are there. It makes sense.
Exactly. And I just, every year I laugh about it. If she ever hears this interview, she's going to be so mad that I know this. What? Oh, yes. In the fact that when I was 11 years old, St. Nicholas, on St. Nicholas night, brought me my first tarot deck. Mm. So wrap your head around that. Fortune telling, which, you know, in the church's law is really not allowed. And one of the saints is leaving my first tarot deck in my shoe for me when I wake up in the morning when I'm 11 years old. So, you know, there's some very much this idea of, at least coming from my mother and grandmother, well, we know best, and we know that the saints and Mary and everyone have our best interests at heart. So of course they're going to understand what we do. And my mother would even say, God knows things, but Mary understands. Mm. So if you have a problem, you pick up the rosary and you pray to Mary, because Mary's going to understand your problems better, and she's going to take care of you.
Yeah,
so
I love that.
there's all kinds of, and growing up in it, steeped in it, even though I went to a Southern Catholic school that was not infused with Italian Americans, it's probably the only Italian American family in the school, I didn't realize that I was growing up with this different kind of Catholicism that wasn't like everyone else's Catholicism, and that was heavily reliant on this kind of very idiosyncratic personal view of how Catholicism works, and the flexibility of it was wild. You know, could encompass a lot of things that other people's Catholicism didn't have room for.
Yeah, no, that flexibility. I mean, and I think we find that so often in folk religions generally, but folk Catholicism, of course, very specifically, that whole, you only need it three times in your life. And then the sort of like, and you only really need to go twice a year, you know,
right?
Kind of like, there's a bare minimum threshold that you can meet really easily. And then everything else is up to you. I think that's really fascinating and beautiful in its own way, because there's so much room for improvisation too. So you mentioned St. Nicholas bringing you your first tarot deck. Divination is really important to you. I know this is a major part of your life. I'm curious, you know, both from kind of your background and your own experiences, what does divination mean to you? Is it fortune telling? Is it personal insight? Is it both, neither, something more? Like, what, where does it fall for you?
Oh my goodness, it's everything. You know, having started with it so young, and I started out with it by reading some book from the Louisville Free Public Library system that mentioned tarot cards and showed a picture of two or three cards in the book, going to my mother and saying, I want these. I had no idea what they were, but there was just this instant galvanic reaction, like I must have these. And it was the following December that I got my first copy. And so I started working with tarot. And I found out later, you know, my mother had consulted with my grandmother and said, do you think this is okay? And my grandmother, who had used and, you know, and had a card reader, her card reader that she went to all her life, you know, said, of course, you know, this is marvelous. Let's get her a deck of cards. Now, when grandma closely inspected the tarot, she went, not the same as the cards that my reader uses. And I, for the longest time, assumed that maybe her card reader had used Lenormand. I now think she probably was using Scopa or a Sibylla deck, but I don't really know. Grandma's not around to ask anymore. But still, I had a lot of support from my mother and grandmother to work with the tarot and to start learning it, because that's what I had available to me. Well, tarot was this gateway drug to all of the Western mystery traditions, of course. And so by the time 14, 15 hit, I decided that, you know, when I grew up, I was going to be a member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. I didn't quite realize how that it had like completely disbanded many, many years before I was born. So I got very, very interested in other types of esoteric practices. And so that is when the multifaceted nature of tarot started to really hit. It started out as a fortune-telling tool and then evolved into a meditative tool and a tool for self-insight, and, you know, has become this major thread throughout my life because of its significance both to my family's practice, but also then my later practices, and it's just expanded and expanded. So, you know, to me, I strongly believe that it can be used as a tool that occasionally opens up these amazing insights into what your future is going to be, while also realizing that it can also work very mechanically as a tool for randomization to give you creative inspiration about what the future might bring or how you might resolve an issue or problem. And then, of course, as an archetypal meditative tool, it's, you know, beyond compare. So I have really this multifaceted and deep love of tarot. So that's probably a namby-pamby question, because I don't have just one use or one perspective on what divination in general and tarot in specific can do.
Sure. No, I love that. I love how rich that kind of an answer can be. It's, you know, if I ask a question like that, there's never just one answer. And I love it, because it is such a rich source of inspiration and thought and, you know, and practice. I love that. You also mentioned, of course, that you got very involved. Well, you wanted to be a part of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Not again, not realizing like, oh, well, I'd have to develop time traveling skills at some point in order to do that. Just like poor St. Francis, right?
Yep, exactly. St. Francis to help.
Yeah. But so eventually you did make your way into more ceremonial, magical spaces and practices, and you're running teaching covens as well. I'm curious, how do other traditions influence the sort of folk practice, or how does your folk practice influence your work in those traditions? How are you merging kind of the modern with the traditional and the esoteric?
It's weird for me, because I think, honestly, even after all this time, there is this divide in my head. Mm-hmm. I have spent many years, about 20 of them, teaching people different, you know, teaching workshops and doing presentations on esoteric practices. And it has only been since my book has come out that I have started really publicly speaking on my family's practices. I've spent all this time talking about more modern and kind of more neo-pagan practices, and then an occasional like general folk magical practices. But to really open up about my family's practices, I've just started doing that within the last few years. And I think there's still this divide in my head where for the longest time, it sounds so odd, but like growing up and being interested in the esoteric from an early age and reading all these books and never seeing in those books reflect what my family did, I felt as though like my family's practices, I got this message that they were somehow lesser, that they weren't to be talked about, that none of my cool magical friends are going to want to know, you know, what mom and grandma did, because, you know, that's just not, they're not, it's not in the books, it's not interesting. That was another major driver for me to write the book that I wrote, in that I wanted people who grew up with Italian American folk practices to be able to find a book on the shelf that at least sort of described what they did, if not exactly described it. So really, I'm still working with publicly speaking and teaching about my family's specific practices. And I kept those two topics divided for a very long time.
And I mean, I think that makes sense. And I do think there is a, you know, there can be a bias. It's weird because I think there for a long time has been a bias against folk magic as somehow sort of lesser than, not really among people who are practicing it a lot or people who are deeper in magical spaces, but certainly at that sort of surface level. But there has been a little bit of a shift in that. And I think now we're in a space where people recognize the value of folk magic and they're spending more time with it and seeing the value. And I know, you know, ceremonial magic occasionally takes its own hits, you know, in that process. But, you know, I think it's really fascinating to think about those two things kind of coming together and potentially influencing each other. So tell me a little bit about the process of writing this book. You said, you know, it wasn't really until you wrote this book that you really thought about kind of bringing the stuff to the forefront and sharing it with folks. And now you've written a full book on this, plus a chapter in our complete book, Llewellyn's complete book of North American folk magic, that talk about some of these practices. You know, one, why now? Two, what was this process like to get this book together and bring it out?
Okay, well, I will try to tell this story without crying.
Oh no.
it's good tears, but I get emotional. So I started out with an idea that I was going to write a little, maybe chapbook sized book on my family's specific practices and get it independently published, because as I told my partner, I said, I just want my daughter to be able to hold our practices in her hand. Mm. If I sell a few copies, that'll be great. And maybe I'll be able to, you know, talk a little bit about it when I go and do my classes and stuff like that. And I even said to my partner, I said, I don't even know if there's enough stuff to make a whole book, you know, and he said, just start writing. There will be plenty, is what he reassured me. So, you know, I wrote a draft and it was an okay draft. And it was very much written for kind of me to just make this small chapbook. And it was just about the time that the app Clubhouse started to really take off and take press, you know, people started paying attention. And so I hopped on Clubhouse and started networking and meeting people. And I met somebody who was an agent for books on metaphysical, esoteric, New Age stuff. And she was kind enough to take a look at my manuscript. And she, you know, I ended up hiring her as a book coach to help me kind of to fix up the manuscript. And like halfway through that process, she's like, I want to have a serious conversation with you because I think that this book could be traditionally published if you continue to work at it the way you have been working at it. And I was wondering if you'd want me to represent you. And I nearly fell over. And so I did some thinking about it and I thought, this is too good an opportunity to pass up. I have been obsessed with books my entire life. I have collected books on the esoteric and metaphysical my entire life. And to think of just even considering a book I wrote actually being traditionally published on a topic that was so important to me, it was just like overwhelming. I like got off the call with this, with my agent, and like just curled up in a ball and cried for a while. And another thing that was contributing to all of this is that my father, who passed away a few years ago, all my life has said to me, D, write a book. I don't care what it's about, just write a book. And sorry, here I go.
No, you're perfectly fine.
And all of the events that took place around publishing this book always happened within a day or two of his birthday. And I could feel him with me the entire time. And so I definitely credit him with a large part of the story of how this book came about, because I really do feel like he was like my partner on the other side and helping things line up, because everything just lined up beautifully from completing the second draft to the proposals going out for the book and getting interest on it almost immediately. I mean, the story that never happens with a first-time author. It happened to me, and I felt just colossally blessed by all of it, particularly the publishing house Watkins that eventually agreed to publish the book. You know, they have a long, long history, esoteric history. They were created by a theosophist in London. Like, just all it, I cannot express, obviously I'm doing a poor job of it right now, how wonderfully perfect, how wonderfully timed, and how affirming it was for me that I was on the right path, how things fell into line. So it in my, when I look back on it, it looks like one day I was sitting there with this little privately published chapbook that I was just going to make 100 copies of and maybe sell one or two copies of. And then it seems like I blinked and I was busy picking out cover art and, you know, answering questions about the internal art, and suddenly I have a full-fledged real-life book on my hands. And it's probably, aside from the birth of my daughter, one of the most marvelous things that's ever happened to me in my life.
That's beautiful. I love that. I don't think that was poorly expressed at all. I think that was absolutely beautiful. And I didn't know the component of this about your father being so closely interwoven with this, but I love that this clearly carries a piece of him out into the world through what you've written. That's beautiful. I mean, this may feel a little bit like a shift, but you know, I think this does tie in a little bit. You talked about Clubhouse being kind of where you found this agent. It's also where you've connected with people and, you know, helped to form relationships that can become teaching relationships and things like that too. I'm curious, you know, you've done a lot of teaching in the magical tradition. What draws you to teaching as a part of this, and what kind of teacher do you feel like you are?
Well, it all started because I fell into teaching at work in a corporate environment and lucked into getting a lot of training on adult education. And when that happened in my life, and I started to really think about people who don't have the resources, whether it be the time to do the research or the access to the materials I have had access to over my life, or the access to actual practitioners that I've had over my life, those folks who are interested in starting their magical journey or enhancing their magical or esoteric practices, you know, what could be done? And the only thing I could think of is, like, I can start creating course content, I can start building classes, and I can start presenting them. That makes it all sound a lot more tidy in retrospect than it actually was in practice, because it always seems to fall beautifully together when you look at it in hindsight. But that's really what started things off, is that I have had for the past 20 plus years, this driving urge that for anyone who is interested, but who might not know how to get started, or who might not know what the next step is, to open the door up and say, come on in, this is the route you can take. This is the way you can get started. These are the tools that you can use, because I realized that not everybody is an obsessed bookworm like I am, and you dig through reference materials and books and track down sources and figure out and put things together. Not everyone has the time nor the inclination to do those things, but they still want the knowledge. They still want the technique, and they still want a connection with someone who is an experienced practitioner. And so that spawned all of the courses that I have taught and am teaching today.
Yes. And then I 100% agree with your point about, like, you can look backwards and it seems like it all falls neatly into place. And in the moment, that is not what I think that's true for the writing the book too. Like, we can look back and go like, oh, it all falls neatly into place. That's never quite how it worked out. Although in your case, it sounds like it very nearly did. It was a very, very smooth process in some ways. I'm curious if, you know, if somebody were signing up for one of your classes or preparing to read your book, you know, what kind of one piece of advice would you give them to get them ready to get started working either with Italian American magic or with their own kind of folk traditions?
I would say that the major piece of advice I would have for anybody getting started is that you've got to get your hands dirty and experiment, because you never know what techniques are going to work for you until you try them out. You know, you can get advice from people, you can read books, you can take classes, you can learn all about a particular technique. Until you sit down and try it, you'll never know if that technique works for you or not. And whether that technique works for you or not does not mean you are good or bad at, quote, magic. All it means is that technique is good or bad for you. And if that technique doesn't work, there's another one that's going to work fantastically for you, but you won't know till you try.
I love that. Yeah. Anything where somebody starts off with, well, you got to get your hands dirty, I'm like, yes, I'm with you. I will subscribe to your newsletter. Yes, for sure. I love that. Okay. So you've written this wonderful book that people can actually go out and get it right now by the time this is out, because it's been out. It came out early 2023, right?
Correct. Oh, no. The Burn a Black Candle came out October 2022.
Oh, okay. There we go. So that came out October 2022, and we've got our new complete book that just came out in 2023. So they can find you in both of those. Highly recommend picking up both, because especially if you're interested in Italian American folk magic, there's a lot that you can get between the two of them. But you stay very busy, as we said at the top of this, and you've got these books that are out now. What's next for you? What happens next for Dee?
I'm frantically working on some other projects. I am currently finishing up, I had a little independently published Les Normand deck called the Emblemata Les Normand. I am almost to the point of independently publishing a detailed guidebook to that deck, but it is still not ready. I thought for sure it would be done in January, and here we are at the end of April. It's not done yet. So I'm in the process of working on that. I am also in the process of working on a book on grimoire magic, but that's not going to come out for a while yet. Mm-hmm. And then there is another project that I may be working on soon having to do with creating an oracle deck. And so that's currently what's on my plate. And then I have some appearances this year that I'm very much looking forward to. I am going to be at Mystic South in Atlanta, Georgia in July. I'll be presenting a workshop on the evil eye, on diagnosing and curing it. In August, I'm going to be at Michigan Sisters in Crime talking about my book and about what it's like to get a contract for traditional publishing. And then in October, I'm going to be at the Multiverse Convention in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm going to be a guest at that convention, participating in several panels and potentially doing a talk for their Learn Track about, I hope if they accept it, I haven't gotten a response back, but occult practices in pop culture, is it real? So the stuff you see on Supernatural or Chilling Adventures of Sabrina or in the movie A Dark Song, how true to real life occult practices are those things?
I love that. Yeah, I love that. A Dark Song is one of those ones that when I watched it, I was like, I didn't think you would put this into a movie, but there we are. All right, good for us.
It is my favorite horror movie of all time.
It's pretty fantastic. Yeah, for those who haven't seen it, it's basically it's the ritual of Abremelin, right? Yeah, and it's very, very detailed. Not perfect, I don't think, but I mean, for a movie, it's shockingly detailed. But anyway, so much good stuff coming up. Hopefully I'll get to see you at Mystic South. I'm hoping they didn't schedule us at cross times so I can maybe go to your Evil Eye workshop because I love that stuff. So
I have scheduled it across times because your presentation last year was my favorite presentation
oh, thank
of the
you.
whole thing, and
That's pretty
including
sweet.
all of the Gravity Falls references.
I do try to work this. There's another pop culture occult reference that we can fit in loosely. So, oh my goodness, Dean Norman, thank you so much for joining us on New World Between. It's been a delight to have you here, and cannot wait for people to find your work and learn so much more about Italian American folk magic and your traditions and your practices as well. So, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Special thanks to Dee Norman for joining us. If you'd like to find out more, please check out her book, Burn a Black Candle, an Italian American Grimoire, available through Bookshop, Amazon, or wherever books are sold. And you can also find her online at her Black Candle Cottage website. We'll put a link in our show notes. Thanks as well to you, all of our listeners who keep us going, send us messages, and let us know what you like, what you don't like, what you'd like more of here on New World Witchery. We really appreciate that. And you can reach us at any time by emailing us at compassandkey@gmail.com or at newworldwitcherypodcast@gmail.com. Both of those will reach us. You can also find us on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram, sometimes Facebook as well. And we've got a YouTube channel too, if you'd like to check that out with some conversations and short videos on folk magic. You can also support us by throwing $1 a month or whatever you can afford into our magical hat by going to patreon.com/newworldwitchery. We do appreciate all of that support. You also unlock some cool bonus features, things like a couple of extra episodes a year. You wind up with early access to everything, get newsletters, and some other cool stuff just kind of thrown into the mix too. So we highly appreciate all of our patrons and all of their support. So thank you all for keeping us going. That will about do it for us this time around. Please do feel free to contact us if you have questions about this show or any other. And we hope you enjoyed our interview with Dee Norman. Until next time, thanks so much for listening and be well. New World Witchery is a production of New World Witchery Podcasts and is released under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. The title and closing music for this episode is Woman Blues by Paul F. Guérinos, licensed from AudioSocket.